Today on Idea Tellers.
So everyone has, I think, a good idea. But a good idea is just an idea, and it's not tangible, it's not digestible, not meaningful or relevant to anyone. So what steps do you need to take? So you have idea A, but you need idea B or C that is closer to the heart of the audience.
Japanese author Kyota Ko joins Idea Tellers as a guest to help us learn what creativity entails and how we can improve it in our teams. This is Idea Tellers. Hola, mi gente. Welcome to another edition of Idea Tellers. I am very excited because I'm interviewing one of the best storytellers I've met in my life. His name is Kyota Ko from Japan, and he's the author of Tales of Japan, 28 Japanese folk tales with cultural commentary. Bienvenido. Welcome, Kyota.
Thank you for having me today. I'm very excited to have a chance to talk with you. You're like, we call it senpai. Senpai means like a senior colleague, like a person you look up to, as in a podcaster.
Well, that feeling of senpai is what I have for you as a storyteller. So thank you. It means a lot. Kyota, I just found out that you are actually a musician by trade. Am I right?
I used to be. That's what I was doing as a side hustle when I had my first job as an English teacher here in Japan. And I was doing that for 10 years. I released a couple of CDs a long time ago through a record label. And I went on iTunes and sold like several songs. And then I stopped there. I realized, you know, I can't continue. Maybe it's not my thing.
Was it something that it was becoming too hard, or it just wasn't there anymore? The reason why I'm asking is because I studied 12 years of music theory in Venezuela.
Oh, really?
Here, yeah. And my dad was a musician, a singer, and a choir director. I thought that was going to be what I was going to do when I grew up. And it turned out that life took me in a very different direction. The only thing I was able to do professionally was 6 years singing with the Utah Opera, which I love. Right. And then life took me in a different direction. So I'm curious, was it that you thought, okay, that chapter, I need to close it and I need to move to the next thing?
Or is
it
pretty much? So I realized, you know, I probably started music, you know, because I wanted to be popular. I think, I don't know, half of all musicians start like that.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember I started playing the violin because the girl I liked in kindergarten, she started violin. That's why I said I want violin. My mom was open to new things. So she said, okay. And then she bought me a violin. And then I think like a year later, the girl quit. And I wanted to quit too. You know, violins, you may know, it's not the cheapest instrument, right?
No, it's not.
Oh, I didn't get to quit. So I just went on for another 18 years playing the violin. And then because I could play it, I started learning composition and music theory in university. I actually said I was going to be an economics major to my dad. And then second year, I switched to music major. I was trying to probably justify my life, you know, up to there. By pursuing it. But when I was in my like late 20s, I realized, you know, I'm not spending enough time on this. I can't consistently be in front of the computer or be in front of the piano to compose. Maybe it's not my thing. You know? I'm trying to make myself think it's my thing, but it's not.
So let me ask you about this. It caught my attention very powerfully. I'm telling you, when I sat on the piano trying to come up with something, anything, and I just couldn't compose a lot of stuff. It was really hard for me. I realized at a certain point, this is not my forte. I like interpreting, you know, I like singing, but this is not the way I can express myself through composition, you know? Did you find at that moment a different way? Because right now you are a great storyteller. So was that a journey that you had to go through? Or when you had that realization, you said, well, I need to try new things. Can you tell me a little bit about that, please?
Well, yeah, I feel I matured like just last year. I think I always feel that. Every year I feel that way. I matured just last year. So I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, my 20s, I was not thinking at all.
Okay.
For myself. I'm just trying to not drown. So I don't believe I had a good idea of what I wanted to do, or even that I had to try something new. I just couldn't continue anymore. I continued as long as I could and I went on. But I did pick up a lot of skills, and I do remember several things. Actually, my professors taught me through their courses. I had two takeaways that I still, it's part of my motto, I think. Like my music theory teacher, he was actually a half Brazilian, half German, and he had a Japanese wife. So, you know, and then I was in North Carolina University.
Okay.
You know, and they're like me and one other Japanese person there. And I remember he said, you know, when you go to a restaurant, you hear music, right? You hear background music. And then the question is, do you remember what that music was or what kind of tricks it played or what it was all about? What he was trying to say is, if you don't stop to think, well, what just happened? You hear some music and you don't think what just happened, then it's nothing different from the noise outside of cars passing by. It's exactly the same. That's not music in the artistic sense. It's just elevator music, right? It's just noise. It's just pleasant noise.
Yeah.
Right. So it needs to, if you're trying to make something meaningful in the artistic sense, then you need to, you know, make people stop think what happened there. Right. And I picked that up. I think that's a blessing and a curse. You know, I don't think that's a good idea to bring in if you're trying to make it big in the pop music world. can disturb with your success there or your potential for success there. The other thing was my music composition professor, I think through a video, she taught me that one line I picked up from a gamelan music, Vietnamese gamelan music composer was that he was saying something very, very simple. He just said, you know, I compose a lot of music, but the most important part is linking, connecting two ideas, period. That's the hardest part. And to this day, I think, yes, that's exactly it. Not just for music composition, but for storytelling. Yeah. It's the hardest part. And it's the part that you need a lot of practice, years of practice, to just feel confident in yourself enough so that, so much that you're confident that you will do it naturally. You know, you just sit yourself in front of a computer and then it'll happen. That was not the case until, I don't know, like a year ago or 2 years ago. Right. After a lot of practice.
Wow. So, mi gente, this is one of the lessons. The creative process involves connecting ideas. Would you say that we just need to find the best way in which we can do that, connecting ideas to create something new?
Right. So everyone has, I think, a good idea, but a good idea is just an idea and it's not tangible. It's not digestible, not meaningful or relevant to anyone. So what steps do you need to take? You have idea A, but you need idea B or C that is closer to the heart of the audience. And then you need to find the link. You need to craft the link between your great idea and idea B or C that's more purposed for drawing the attention of the audience. So you need to create some dots too, dots, and then the line to connect with the great idea you wanted to tell. You can't just present the great idea you wanted to tell without doing due diligence, right?
Yes. So. I'm sorry, I'm mesmerized because, especially here in America, it's like, yeah, I'm a creative, or the creative process is awesome, but I never get to the nitty-gritty of what it entails. And thank you for teaching us about this. You know, it's not enough of having the idea and knowing your audience. if I understand correctly, is crafting the best connection once you have identified what is going to resonate with your public, with your audience. How did you find out what resonated with your audience? Because your stories about Japan's history and culture really, really got to me. And when you produce your book and you started sharing stories from your book, I said, I gotta have this. This is inspiring. So how did you find your own creative connection with what was at the heart and minds of your audience, if I may ask?
I think it was a gradual process. So I can't really pinpoint what it was. But first of all, it's important to understand that the level of knowledge, the creator, the level of understanding of the subject matter the storyteller has and the audience has, is always very, very different. That's the start. Bridging that gap is pretty much the connector, I think, off the top of my head. But I think that's it. It's just closing the gap. The first level of factor of appreciation of your content is basically, I understand what he's saying. That's the front door. Without going in there, there's nothing more. They're going to leave, right? Because they don't get it. I don't get what you're saying. So, you know, there are many really, really smart people, like even on TED Talks, maybe not recently, but like old TED Talks, I would like scan through them. And then there was this like guy from MIT, super smart. And his invention, like visually, it looks amazing. It was like building blocks of architecture, building themselves because they're automated. Right? And that's a great invention. But the way he's speaking, the content of his speech, you know, all these jargon and all these technical terms, only his closest friend would understand. There's no resonating. It's like, the clap is like, you know, it's due diligence. Nobody got it. Nobody cared about what he's saying. Anyway, his invention is amazing. Looks amazing. Great. Thank you. So he didn't do the diligence. He didn't create the front door, which is to close the gap between his understanding, his level of understanding of the subject matter, and the audience's level of understanding. So there's no enjoyment without doing that.
Yeah, and no human connection, really. Am I right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Right. You're talking to yourself, basically. Right. I might bring this up later, but there are two kinds of talking to yourself. One is the one that I just mentioned. It's just you're saying what's in your mind without being considerate of the people who are spending time reading or listening. Okay. And the other one is you are speaking to yourself, but you are speaking about a topic that you are super fascinated about. And you're just focused on telling this story because it's very, very, very meaningful to you. Now, it works. So basically, when people are moved, when my audience is moved, I have confirmed that when I do the latter version, I'm concentrated, I'm focused fully on what I'm trying to tell because this is so meaningful, this is so fun, this is so moving. And then I look up, and then people are in awe. You know? And they're not in awe about me, they're in awe about the story, the way it was brought to them, brought to their ears, brought to their eyes. But that only happens after you master the craft of bridging the gap by second nature. If you make that second nature, and then if you focus fully on whatever you're passionate about and tell that story, then people are moved. And I think that's how you create fans, create followership.
I want to ask you about a story that I think is in your next book. To me, the culture of the samurai is so cool. That's such a powerful symbol, you know? And it's, in some instances, the epitome of masculinity for many people. And obviously, there is an aspect of being prideful and not yielding and not being humble. But you, in one of the stories, told me that all the opposite. Like, a samurai actually can be kind-hearted, humble.
Oh, yeah.
There was one samurai at the end of the Edo period, I think. He was in charge of a prison.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, exactly. Actually, I was ready to present that story to you. I'm just going to read it right now. had it open here.
Are you kidding me? Yes.
No. Okay. All right. Okay. So this is called The Prisoners of Kodenmacho. Kodenmacho is an address and the name of a station of Tokyo Metro Hibiya Line, if you come to Japan, located in one of Tokyo's many business districts, full of small and bland office buildings standing shoulder to shoulder, just as the people working there would do in the jam-packed commuter trains we ride every workday. Now, things were far grimmer there until just over 150 years ago. During the peaceful Edo period, as you said, unlike the war-heavy previous era, when criminals were typically executed brutally, imprisonment was the most common form of punishment in criminal justice. But that didn't mean the fates of criminal offenders became milder. In the city of Edo, the prison was infamous as the last stop before death. A dozen jails were situated within a 90 square meter space surrounded by walls that were 33 meters high. There was class discrimination in prison too. So the jail made for commoners was often overpopulated, and over 1,000 prisoners died from bad hygiene every year towards the end of the Edo period. Now, the reasons were various. Poor hygiene being one of them, prisoners had a chance to bathe only a few times every month. And those who became ill were shoved into a corner of the room so they wouldn't infect the still healthy ones. Murder was another common cause of death. When a criminal offender was brought to Kodenmacho prison, he went through a body check and then was asked if he had any money with him. And if so, you hand it over. Criminals of Edo were somehow supposed to know that you weren't supposed to give up your money here because you would need it later. After you enter your cell, your senior inmates would ask what you did to deserve to join them, what crime you committed, and then they would ask if you brought the vine of life with you. They have all these jargon. Given that he knew what that meant, what the vine of life meant, would then throw all the coins he had woven into his belt. And if the sum was over 10 ryo, it's like, ryo is like right around $10,000 in today's money, he was a guest. But if he came in without anything or had given up what he brought to the prison guard, the newbie would be tied with a rope and beaten with sticks thrown into the corner for the sick. Some died from infection or wounds, and if not, they were accepted into the gang. So in each cell, 12 prisoners were appointed to roles like leader, medic, and dishwasher, and each cell was run autonomously. Many cells turned into dystopias, ruled by the leader who turned himself into a dictator. For starters, whenever an okappiki is an uncertified civilian police assistant roaming around the city of Edo. So for starters, whenever an okappiki was thrown into jail because they're uncertified police officers and they would indulge in bribery and threatening civilians, they were often caught and they were thrown into jail, you know, because everyone knows who that is. But you didn't have to be an okappiki to get murdered in prison. Whenever the cell started becoming overpopulated, the leader would pick a few cellmates and conduct a fast-track version of the groin kick ritual daily until the crowdedness was controlled. So naturally, the people of Edo thought these prisoners of Kodenmacho were hopeless savages without any plausible moral standards. And I think we would all agree to that, right? But the prisoners and the head prison guard of Kodenmacho proved everyone wrong. Ishide Tatewaki was the name of the prison guard role inherited by the head of the Ishide samurai family over several generations. Burglars who had stolen over 10 ryo or had been caught for committing a crime for the third time got their heads chopped off after months of imprisonment. Tatewaki was in charge of 120 such prisoners in 1657. In January of that year, a third of Edo's population was killed by fire. The whole city was made of wood then, and dry weather and strong winds spread the fire everywhere. There were very few bridges built over the many rivers of Edo for the purpose of protecting the city from potential invasion by regional feudal lords. But ironically, the feature was the reason tens of thousands of victims burned to death, unable to run any further away from the fire beyond rivers. Well, the flames were approaching the prison fast. There was no time to run to the office to receive formal approval to free the prisoners from jail temporarily, and they will be executed within a month. And it was obvious that the prisoners were going to die. But Kakiwaki, he came in front of the prisoners and said, "The keys to your jails are kept out of the way. I bet my life that you will all gather at Zenkeiji Temple in Asakusa after the fire is over. In case you don't, I will make sure to find you and your whole family and put you to my sword." Then he had his men break the metal locks and let the prisoners go. If even one of these prisoners had run and harmed a civilian, Tatewaki would have had to receive the death penalty himself. But perhaps his sense of responsibility as samurai, who was expected to be a role model of humanity, made him exercise his empathy and love. The prisoners ran outside with tears in their eyes. Next day, seeing that all 120 had shown up at Zenkeiji Temple, Tatewaki explained to the government heads that killing off these loyal men would not benefit society. The heads agreed and reduced their penalties. Tatewaki's exceptional deed became the rule thereafter. Prisoners were let go whenever there was fire and were rewarded if they submitted themselves within 3 days.
Yeah.
Wow. Are you in awe and in gratitude with what you just shared? How one gesture of someone in the right place at the right time changed the perception of the system towards a group of people.
Yeah.
That person would have chosen not to show humanity, but he chose that, being in a position of power. That is so touching. Thank you. And mi gente, I want to tell you that Kyotako is not just deliberating. He has walked the walk. And if you follow him on LinkedIn, you will notice that he has mastered the art of knowing the audience. And let's take into consideration, he comes from a different culture, a different language, a different way to share the ideas. So, Kyota, I've seen the way you can relate at an emotional level when you tell folk tales that are so ingrained in Japanese culture, and many of them are ancient, you know? How did you learn a way in which you could relate with an American audience, for instance? Was it trial and error? Was it simply because you were soaking in the American experience when you live in North Carolina? Was it a little bit of both?
Well, my day job, I make learning content for English learners. Long story short, I became a person who creates texts for people to learn English from. And, you know, there's this notion called level appropriateness. So when you write a text for a language learner, depending on where they are in the ladder of language proficiency, you need to adjust the language to that person. Otherwise, the learning curve is going to be steeper than it needs to be.
Yeah, that's true.
So the same idea applies to storytelling realm. We need to write content. We need to deliver content in a level appropriate way. So there's this fine line between dumbing it down, watering it down, and simplifying so that the audience can purely enjoy whatever content you're making. And I've been doing that for a very, very long time, writing level appropriately. And I think that's helped.
Obviously, you've perfected this craft and art, and I commend you for that.
So I've been doing this type of level appropriate writing, level appropriate content creation for, I don't know, like 8 years full time. So it was grueling, but that is why I am able to do it as second nature. And I'm grateful for that. Now I'm ready to focus more time, spend more time on actually creating content that matters to me.
And thank you for doing that. I think that took courage, and obviously I can tell that you are a very self-disciplined artist. I want to ask you a little bit about a couple of, or at least one of the stories that you tell. The ones that get to me more deeply is the ones in which the individual is not after something for himself, but actually looks at his community and does something to help others, to help his fellow men or her fellow citizens out of an altruistic motive. You know?
Mm.
One is from your book and the other one I think is from your next book. There is a story about a farmer who noticed that an imminent tsunami was coming, right? And that really touched me. And the fact that that story has endured the test of time. Is there a particular connection that the story made with you, or is it the same that I'm mentioning?
To add to that story. So basically this guy who was very introverted, and that's the key point for me. Because I'm an introvert too. So he has a girl he likes in the same village he lives in, and he couldn't, you know, ask her out for a long time. You know, and the introverts, they're always imagining of this catastrophe, like in movies, you know, and then you come into the rescue and, you know, that's how love starts, they think. But that actually happens, right? A long earthquake happened. And then he remembers his grandfather was saying, after a long earthquake, a tsunami is coming. The tsunami is coming. He sees it. And then everyone was at the local shrine. Having a great time in the local festival. And then he needed a way to let them know that a tsunami was coming or something was wrong immediately. And he thought, you know, maybe I can burn somebody's farm, somebody's field, so that it'll create a big bonfire. But he was too introverted. He was too kind to burn somebody else's field. He went ahead and burned his own field. That got me. You know, yes, I think I would do that. You know, as a Japanese person, I wouldn't have the audacity to, you know, burn it, even if it wasn't save lives. Right. You know, and then everything goes well, and then he saves the day. And at the end of the story, he is together with the girl he loves. Everything worked out. I had a personal connection with that. It's not like there's a profound message there, but actually, this folktale is based on a true story. There was an actual person that did that. It was like probably 150 years ago.
How did this story resonate with you, if I may ask?
I think many scholars about Japanese history or culture, they advocate the idea that it's hard to translate, but or Japanese people value the beauty in sorrow, beauty in that sorrowful feeling you get when, let's say, you know, your father passed away and then you remember all these things you did with him. For example, it's sorrowful, but there is a sense of beauty that you feel.
Well, mourning, you mean? Yeah, there's a sense of beauty in mourning then.
Yes, sense of beauty in mourning. It's not that, you know, people want to be sentimental all the time, right? There's this other value, which is forgiveness, forgiving or generosity towards others in hardships. So because Japan was not a modern nation until like the late 19th century, and people died very easily. Children died, like half of all children died before they reached their teens, you know, and then there's sorrow everywhere. So when people really, really value that moment when somebody comes in and they must be in hardships themselves, or in this case of Tatewaki-san, he was risking his own life, his whole career, his whole family's career, but he would just take that risk and show generosity because people need it. The world needs it. And then if it doesn't work out for me, so be it. And then they just do it.
So, it's a matter of seeing yourself as part of the collective, as part of of humanity. Beautiful. Can you tell me what the word in Japanese is that describes that beauty in mourning, please?
This is called ninjo. I notice, like, among people I connect with on Instagram and LinkedIn, there are several people who are big fans of, like, old-time Japanese cinema. And old-time Japanese cinema, the central theme is about towards others in times of hardships. So this is one of many examples. This is an epic one, but this is one of many examples of ninjo that was happening, especially in Edo period. Edo period it was a time of peace after a very, like a bloodbath era right before it. So Japan was going through a samurai battle royal era. And then that was finished. One samurai family conquered all of Japan. So there was no more battles, finally. So now people could afford to be nice to others. Before then, it was not an option for many. So the Edo period is much about ninjo, at least the way us modern Japanese people understand it. So the value of these kind of stories from history then is that being in the unique position you are in your little community everyone lives in, it's often the case that you are the only person who is in that position or in that position in the family or company, community, right? And it's not that you have a person who is in the exact same circumstances that you can share your struggles and share your problems with. They don't understand because they're not you. But you would feel sometimes lonely or isolated and depressed sometimes when that situation persists. But if you look at history or these folktales too, you find people you've never met, people from different cultures, a country you've never been to even, but you find these people who are in very similar circumstances as you are. And that is when you realize, I share identity or I share belonging in the scope of humanity across time, not just geography, but across time. If you cross time, there is someone like me, an introvert like me, who would save the day 150 years ago. And that feels healing, basically. I have no better word to express this right now, but looking for that word that describes what it is, the value I feel from this. But basically, right now, I could just say it's healing. You find somebody back in the past, not the culture.
There is a dimension that I'm discovering in your work that is very subtle, but is ever present. And when you discover and you have this type of discussions, it's not only evident, but obvious. And it's a sense of empathy.
That's right.
And the world needs that. Now, I'm gonna get a bit personal. My listeners know that. So a year ago, I lost my dad. And the reason why I'm saying this is because your tales and your book are providing healing to me. So thank you. As an artist, as a storyteller, you are doing what you set out to do. You're accomplishing, at least in this Venezuelan America. So thank you. Can you tell us? Well, do you have a name for your next book?
Yes. I'm most certainly going to call it Underdogs of Japanese History. And that was a very shorter type of story. I think I'm going to have 11 stories here. And it will be a bit longer than my first book. And it's all about, it's not folk tales. It's actual stories from Japanese history. And I just finished writing the first draft an hour ago. So I'm going to go and check through everything.
Can't wait to have it ready. So do you have an estimate of when it would be available to American audiences?
Right. I'm shooting for a month. So late August. Yes.
And yeah. By then, this episode will have aired. So yes.
Right now. Thank you. That will work out perfectly.
Once again, thank you, Jotaro, for giving us some of your time and for enlightening us and showing us a little bit more humanity through your work. Gente, if you can find Folk Tales of Japan, 28 Japanese Folk Tales with Cultural Commentary, is it available? It's available on Amazon?
Amazon only at this point, yeah.
So thank you. This is Idea Tellers.